Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I am just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I'm someone who looks at a clinical result and sees the human stories behind the numbers. That's how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I'm here to open up those conversations that the mainstream often finds uncomfortable, anchoring them in my own love of scientific techniques and psychological studies. I am driven by a scientific curiosity, a need to understand the mechanics behind the mayhem. And I know I'm not the only one fascinated by the science of murder and true crime. This show is for those of us who want to move past the headlines and into the laboratory to learn to find and learn together. Today we are discussing the science of cyanide poisoning. In the lab, we're used to the slow drift of toxicology, the way morphine or barbiturates gradually dim the lights until the respiratory drive just quits. Sometimes waiting for that tablet to kick in and ease your headache can feel like an eternity. But when we transition into the world of industrial chemicals, we leave the slow sleep behind. If morphine is a gradual sunset, cyanide is a power surge that blows every fuse in the building. It doesn't ask the body to rest, it sabotages the engine while it's still running at full throttle. This shift takes us from the bedside mercy killings of someone like Jane Toppin and drops us into the cold clinical efficiency of the industrial era. Cyanide is a recurring character in the history of murder because it's a dual citizen. It exists in the pits of apricots and the stems of elderberries, yet it's also the backbone of gold mining and jewelry cleaning. It is as accessible as a fruit bowl and as lethal as high-voltage wire, making it the efficiency killer's tool of choice. When cyanide enters the system, it doesn't stop the heart or the lungs directly. It binds to the cellular mitochondrial iron with a grip that oxygen can't break. It essentially puts a deadbolt on the cell's ability to use oxygen. The victim isn't dying because they can't breathe. They are dying because their cells have forgotten how to breathe. This leads to a unique forensic phenomenon. When we look at a patient in the lab or a body on the table, our eyes are trained to look for the blue shift, that telltale sign of cyanosis, where the lips and fingernails turn a dusky purple because the body is starving for oxygen. But cyanide is a biological paradox. It kills by suffocation, yet the victim often presents with a vibrant, healthy-looking flush. To understand why, you have to look at the color of the blood itself. In a healthy system, there is a stark visual contrast between the two sides of the circulatory loop. Your arterial blood is a bright, vivid scarlet because it's packed with oxygen fresh from the lungs. Once that blood hits the capillary beds, your cells eat that oxygen to fuel the mitochondria. And the blood returning through the veins turns a deep, dark maroon. Now, We have to stop here for a second and address a massive misconception I hear all the time. Your venous blood is not blue. I don't care what your middle school science teacher told you, blood is never blue inside the body. That's an optical illusion caused by the way light interacts with your skin and the vessel walls. As anyone who's ever pulled a dark venous draw in the lab can tell you, it's a deep, deoxygenated red. It only looks blue on the surface because of physics, not biology. Now, the lack of oxygen flattens the bright red, darkening it into something heavy, ink-tinted, and ominous. It's the kind of dark, stagnant red you'd expect to see splashed across the floor of a haunted house. It feels final, used up, and dead. Even if arterial bleeding is the scary one because of the pressure and volume, the venous side is the one that carries the weight of a body that's already exhausted its resources. But in cyanide poisoning, the metabolic exchange that darkens your blood as the oxygen is exchanged never happens. Because the poison acts as a molecular wrench that jams the cellular engine, the cells can't eat the oxygen. The oxygen stays stuck to the hemoglobin, totally useless. When you look at a victim of cyanide poisoning, their venous blood is often a bright, startling cherry red. It's a biological paradox. The body is drowning in oxygen it can no longer use. It's a vibrant, vivid sign of a system that has been forced to shut down from the inside out. When we draw a sample in the lab, the usual visual cues are gone. The venous blood looks nearly identical to the arterial blood. But here is where the forensic waters get muddy. If you see that cherry red flush, your mind might immediately jump to carbon monoxide, and for a good reason. It's the more common accidental killer. Both poisons result in a vibrant, healthy-looking hue that masks the suffocation happening inside, but they arrive at that color through two completely different forms of biological sabotage. Carbon monoxide is a transportation hijacker. It targets the iron in your hemoglobin, the protein that carries oxygen through your blood. Carbon monoxide is a bully. It has an affinity for those seats that is over 200 times stronger than oxygen's. It kicks the oxygen out, sits in the seat, and turns the blood a vivid, stable scarlet. In a carbon monoxide case, the blood is red because the poison itself has dyed the delivery trucks. Cyanide, however, is a power plant saboteur. It doesn't care about the transport trucks. It waits until the oxygen actually arrives in the cell's engine, the mitochondria. There it binds to a different form of iron and an enzyme called cytochrome C oxidase. It eventually puts a deadbolt on the engine. In a cyanide case, the blood is red because it's unused. The oxygen is still sitting in the trucks because the power plant was locked from the inside. It all comes down to the valence state, the specific ionic charge of the iron in your system. Normally, the iron in your hemoglobin is in the ferrous state. This is the version that acts as the seat for the oxygen, but it's also the version that carbon monoxide is looking to bully and hijack. Cyanide, however, has an almost magnetic attraction to ferric iron instead. It completely ignores the oxygen carriers in your veins and goes straight for the ferric iron, tucked away in an enzyme called cytochrome C oxidase inside your mitochondria. It's a molecular hijack that locks the engine in place. Because the cyanide snaps onto that specific ferric iron's charge, it refuses to let go. It doesn't just displace the oxygen. It leaves that oxygen with no seat at the table. The oxygen is there, it's available, but the cellular engine has been deadbolted from the inside. That leads us to the technical smoking gun that separates the two in the lab, the venous arterial PO2 gradient. Normally, there's a massive drop-off between the oxygen in your arteries and the oxygen in your veins. It's the tax your body takes to keep you moving. In a carbon monoxide case, the oxygen never made it onto the trucks, so the pressure readings reflect that empty delivery system. But in a cyanide case, there's a haunting lack of that drop-off. It's the ultimate laboratory red flag, a venous return that looks like a tank full of gas. The body has all the fuel it needs, but the engine is deadbolted, so the oxygen just circles back to the heart, completely untouched. It's a haunting laboratory finding, a map of a body that had all the air it could ever need, but was rendered unable to take a singular cellular breath. And this isn't a modern industrial tragedy. This is biological sabotage, a trick that nature perfected millions of years ago. What's important is that with cyanide, we aren't looking at a failure of the lungs or a simple accident with a faulty space heater. We're looking at a molecular wrench thrown into the gears of life, a poison that is rarely present without intent. People didn't just wake up one day and decide to synthesize a cellular asphyxiant. They noticed that nature had already been perfecting it for millions of years, before it was ever isolated in a laboratory or standardized in a vial. Cyanide was known as the invisible killer of the kitchen and the garden. Long before the first formal distillation in 1782, humanity had a functional, albeit terrifying, relationship with what we now call cyanogenic glycosides, specifically the compound amygdalin. It's hard to read sometimes. We see this early forensic history play out in the courts of ancient Rome. The Romans discovered that if you steep the leaves of the cherry laurel in water, you produced a potent, clear liquid known simply as laurel water. It became the preferred tool for quiet domestic assassinations because of how it mimicked a sudden, catastrophic heart attack. There was no struggle and no blue tint to the skin, just a sudden stop in the middle of a meal. In fact, our very biology evolved as a direct response to these botanical killers. Evolution gave us the ability to detect bitter tastes as a primary defense against the plant kingdom. This was the original bedside toxicology test. If an almond tasted sweet, it was safe. If it carried that distinct, sharp, bitter note, it contained enough amygdalin to kill a small child. It was a sensory warning system designed to keep us from accidentally shutting down our own mitochondria. Further back in Egypt, we find references to the penalty of the peat. It was a specialized form of execution reserved for those who dared to reveal the secrets of the gods. The Egyptian priests would prepare a concoction derived from crushed peach kernels, the center of the stone, and use it as a ritual poison. Even then, they understood that the secret to the divine judgment wasn't found in a blade, but in the concentrated heart of a common fruit. While we can see the cherry red evidence in the blood and the massive PO2 shift on a printout, nature provided us with one final sensory warning system: the scent of hydrogen cyanide. To those who can detect it, it's described as a sharp, acrid aroma of bitter almonds. This isn't just a literary trope from an Agatha Christie novel, it's a chemical reality that ties directly back to these cyanogenic glycosides that we find in nature. Before it was a refined lab-grade powder like potassium cyanide, it was hiding in plain sight, tucked away in the crushed peach kernels, apple seeds, and the glossy leaves of the cherry laurel. When these precursors were crushed or digested, they released the hydrogen cyanide gas, essentially off-gassing a warner that the power plant saboteur is present. But in the world of forensics and the medical lab, this warning system comes with a terrifying caveat: the genetic blind spot. The ability to smell cyanide is actually a specific, often X-linked trait. This means that roughly 20 to 40% of the population is completely smell blind to the aroma. They can stand over a beaker or a body saturated in lethal concentrations of hydrogen cyanide and smell absolutely nothing. Imagine the tension in an autopsy suite or a high-stakes toxicology lab. You're standing shoulder to shoulder with a colleague. To the end, the air is screaming a warning. The scent of bitter almonds is thick and unmistakable. They are reaching for a respirator, their pulse spiking as they recognize the invisible executioner in the room. But to you, it's just another Tuesday. You don't smell the almonds. You don't smell the bitterness. You are breathing in a cellular assassin with every relaxed breath, completely unaware that your mitochondria are being padlocked in real time. In our line of work, that genetic roll of the dice isn't an interesting trivia point. It's a professional hazard that turns a simple sensory check into a game of Russian roulette. To go from the genetic roll of the dice in our sinuses to the hard evidence on a lab bench, we have to look at the man who gave this killer its name, Carl William Scheele. In 1782, Scheele became the first to isolate prussic acid. But his discovery is less a triumph of modern chemistry and more of a cautionary tale to anyone working in a lab today. The ultimate 18th century lab rat, possessed by a scientific curiosity that was quite literally suicidal. He had the lethal habit of tasting his discoveries, a common, albeit horrifying, practice of the era. He described the taste of cyanide as peculiar, but not unpleasant, a little warm in the mouth. It's the ultimate MLS dark punchline. Scheele wasn't just tasting the cyanide, his workbench was a rotating menu of arsenic, mercury, and oxalic acid. He famously described the taste of barium as not unpleasant and hydrofluoric acid as exceedingly corrosive. By the time he was found dead at his desk at the age of 43, his organs were essentially a walking periodic table of toxicity. But before we get back to that warm taste of cyanide, we have to recognize the history of chemistry is essentially the Darwin Awards of the scientific world. If you think Scheele was an outlier, look at Constantine Fallberg in 1879. He's working on coal tar derivatives at Johns Hopkins, goes home for dinner, bites into a bread roll, and finds it's intensely sweet. Does he think he's having a stroke? No, he realizes he didn't wash his hands after playing with the coal tar. He literally ran back to the lab and started tasting everything on his workbench until he found the culprit, saccharin. Then you've got James Schlatter in 65, who licks his finger to turn a page while working on anti-ulcer drugs and gives us aspartame. Or the researcher at Queen Elizabeth College, who was told to test a chlorinated sugar compound, thought his supervisor said, taste it, and discovered sucralose. The recurring theme in science seems to be lick your finger, find a billion-dollar sweetener. But lick your finger with Scheele's prussic acid, you get a toe tag. However, Scheele's final taste test gave us the foundation for the very first forensic identification of this poison, the Prussian blue reaction. This is where we move from the tasting error of, into actual forensic chemistry. Scheele proved that the lethal spirit found in Roman laurel water was the exact same chemical found in the deep blue pigment used by painters. By adding ferrous sulfate to an alkaline solution of stomach contents, followed by a dash of acid, you create a brilliant deep blue precipitate called ferric ferrous cyanide. It was the literal aha moment for the 18th century. It took a clear, invisible, and odorless killer and turned it into a pigment so stable it's still used in blueprints and paints today. So, how did we go from blue paint to body on a floor? It started in the garden. For thousands of years, we knew that bitter meant death. Field just gave that death a name and a concentrated form. He took a natural defense mechanism from a peach pit and turned it into the most efficient industrial killer in history. But Scheele's work did something more dangerous than just providing a test. It concentrated the threat. Before Scheele, if you wanted to kill someone with cyanide, they had to drink a massive, bitter-tasting cup of laurel water or peach pit tea. It was hard to hide. Once Scheele isolated prussic acid, the dose became microscopic. You no longer needed a cup of poison, you only needed a few drops. Once he published his findings, the professional mask of the killer changed forever. Doctors and pharmacists realized that the same chemicals they were using to manufacture blue dye could be used to stop a heart in seconds. Scheele took a natural defense mechanism from the center of a peach pit and refined it into the most efficient industrial killer in human history. I'll admit, as a girl who sucks at the sleep thing, my mind goes to strange places as it attempts to power down. As I was editing this episode, I was thinking about that classic Cold War trope, the spy with the cyanide capsule hidden in a false tooth. In the movies, they bite down and it's instant painless, lights out to protect their secrets and often foil the hero. But in reality, that's not how biology works. If you bite a capsule of potassium cyanide, you aren't hitting a kill switch. You're starting a violent chemical reaction in your mouth and throat. As we've talked about, that salt has to react with your stomach acid to become the lethal gas, or it has to be absorbed through your mucous membranes. You aren't falling asleep. You're experiencing a massive systemic seizure. Your muscles tighten, you grasp for air your cells can't use, and you likely lose control of your bodily functions. It is a several-minute struggle of cellular suffocation that is anything but quiet or dignified. Hollywood loves the instant death because it's clean for the plot, but in the lab, we know that the physics of metabolic failure is a much louder, much more violent exit. In the cases we described today, no one went peacefully or instantly with a smile on their face. That messy, violent reality, the one Hollywood tries to skip over, was exactly what the world was starting to learn the hard way. By the mid-19th century, the secret Scheele had uncovered was no longer confined to the sterile safety of a laboratory bench. Chemists and criminals alike began to realize that cyanide was essentially everywhere. It was in the vibrant dyes of your floral wallpaper, the pits of the cherries in your kitchen, and the medicinal tonics sitting on the pharmacy shelf. This ubiquity created the perfect environment for a deadly kind of domestic camouflage. Because it was a clear liquid that mimicked the scent of a common baking ingredient, it became the ultimate tool for a murderer who wanted to bypass the natural defenses of a healthy household. This is exactly where we find the 1845 case of John Towell. A man whose crime would mark a turning point for both forensic science and modern technology. Towell was a Quaker who lived in a life of outward piety, but he had a complicated and expensive secret. A former mistress named Sarah Hart, who lived in a small cottage in Slough. When the financial burden of her support became too much, Towell decided to apply Seal's concentrated threat. He slipped into Sarah's home and stirred a lethal dose of prussic acid into her glass of stout. As Sarah lay dying, Tal slipped away and boarded a train for London. Confident by the time her body was discovered, he would be lost in the anonymity of the city. He almost made it. But this was the dawn of the high-tech chase. Witnesses had seen a Quaker in a brown coat leaving the cottage, and for the first time in human history, data moved faster than the killer's train. Using the newly installed electric telegraph, the authorities sent a message ahead to Paddington Station. Because the telegraph didn't have a code for the letter Q, the operator had to get creative, spelling it out as KWAKER. When Tal stepped off that train in London, he wasn't met with anonymity. He was met by a tailing detective. But the real lab win happened back at the morgue. Tal's defense that Sarah had died of exhaustion or natural causes, a common alibi in the era before routine toxicology. However, prosecution called upon chemists to utilize the Prussian blue reaction. They didn't just find a stomach full of beer, they pulled the vibrant blue proof of poison out of that stout, defeating the alibi and proving that the invisible killer was in fact present. Tal's execution was the first time the public realized that neither distance nor a pious reputation could protect a murderer from the combination of a chemist's tests and a telegraph's wire. Then, as we move into from 19th century tonics of John Tal into the cold, calculated hits of the late 20th century, we see the science of murder stripped of its domestic mask and replaced by an industrial ruthlessness. This is where we find Richard the Iceman Kuklinski, a contract killer for the New Jersey crime families who treated the human body less like a biological system and more like a faulty piece of machinery to be decommissioned. Kuklinski's favorite tool wasn't a blade or a bullet. It was a common plastic nasal spray bottle. But inside that bottle wasn't saline. It was a concentrated solution of cyanide. Kuklinski understood a fundamental principle of toxicology that many domestic killers overlook. The route of administration changes the speed of the engine failure. When you stir cyanide into a stout or hide it in a peach pit, poison has to run the gauntlet of the digestive system. It has to survive stomach acid, pass through the gut wall, and endure the first pass metabolism of the liver before it ever reaches the mitochondria. That takes time. Precious minutes where a victim might realize something is wrong. By using an aerosolized mist, Kuklinski bypassed the gut entirely. When he approached a target in a crowded space and sneezed a fine spray toward their face, the cyanide particles hit the mucous membranes of the nose and the deep alveolar sacs of the lungs. This provided an almost instantaneous path into the bloodstream. The result was a near-instant cardiac arrest that looked to any untrained bystander like a tragic natural widowmaker heart attack. Because the dose was delivered via aerosol, there was no bitter almond residue in the stomach for a coroner to find, and no puncture marks from a needle. Kuklinski was utilizing the cellular deadbolt mechanism at its most efficient. He wasn't just killing a man, he was initiating a systemic electrical failure of the heart before the victim could even register the scent. It was a cold, industrial application of Scheele's discovery. Kuklinski didn't care about the Prussian blue beauty of the chemistry. He only cared that the aerosol hit left the professional mask of a de natural death intact. It turned the most crowded streets into a private execution chamber, Proving that in the hands of a predator who understands the science of murder, even the air you breathe can be weaponized. And then, as we move into the 1970s, the science of murder takes a dark domestic turn that shattered the innocence of an entire American tradition. This is the case with Ryan Clark O'Brien, a man who didn't just understand the chemistry of cyanide, he weaponized the very trust of a child. In the lab, we often talk about the matrix of a sample, the environment a poison sits in. And for O'Brien, that matrix was a 21-inch giant pixie stick. The motive was as cold as any industrial hit. O'Brien was drowning in over $100,000 of debt. His solution wasn't a career change or a loan, it was a life insurance payout. He took up massive policies on his own children. And then, on a rainy Halloween night in 1974, he handed his 8-year-old son, Timothy, a candy straw laced with a lethal dose of potassium cyanide. In the lab, we know that potassium cyanide in its salt form is dangerous, but the real executioner is what happens when that salt hits the gut. This is the gastric reaction. When Timothy tilted that pixie sticks back, the potassium cyanide powder hit the hydrochloric acid in his stomach. Chemically, the acid liberated the cyanide from its salt bond, forming hydrogen cyanide gas internally. The tragedy of this case is that Timothy had a sensory warning, but he was too young to understand it. He complained to his father that the candy tasted bitter and gross. In a chilling display of this killer's mask, O'Brien gave his son a glass of Kool-Aid to wash down the taste, effectively helping the poison dissolve and react faster. The shutdown was almost immediate. Within minutes, Timothy was in the bathroom, experiencing the violent final gasps of cellular asphyxiation. Because the hydrogen cyanide was being generated inside his own stomach, it was being absorbed directly into his bloodstream and rushed to his mitochondria. His power plants didn't just dim, they were detonated from the inside out. The O'Brien case wasn't just a clinical failure of cellular respiration. It was a calculated attempt to create a forensic red herring using the lives of other children. Ronald Clark O'Brien didn't just target his own son, Timothy, in a chilling move to build his mask as a grieving father caught in a random tragedy. He prepared five lethal pixie sticks. He handed the disease out to Timothy, his daughter Elizabeth, and three other neighborhood children. It was a terrifying gamble with a high-count body trail. Fortunately, the other four children either couldn't get the staples out of the top of the oversized candy straws or simply weren't hungry. One child was even found asleep in bed later that night, clutching the tainted candy. He had tried to open it but lacked the strength, a technical failure that saved his life. The moment Timothy collapsed, the grieving father act shifted into a calculated, frantic hunt for a phantom. O'Brien didn't just play the victim, he directed a literal wild goose chase through the rain-soaked streets of the Deer Park neighborhood. He pointed investigators toward a specific dark house, spinning a cinematic tale of a shadowy figure reaching through a cracked door to hand out the lethal candy. It was a classical mask move, trying to manufacture a local urban legend to hide the clinical reality of the potassium cyanide salt he'd poured into those straws. He was betting on the panic of a community to drown out the quiet, consistent evidence sitting in the lab. But the science of murder doesn't just happen in the toxicology lab. It happens in the timeline of an investigation. Detectives quickly realized the truth didn't add up. They went to the house, so Brian pointed out, and found out the owner was a local air traffic controller who hadn't even been home. He was at work, with dozens of witnesses and time cards to prove it. The critical moment for the investigators came when they realized O'Brien was the only person who could remember which house the candy came from, yet he couldn't describe the man's face. When the lab confirmed that the top 2 inches of Timothy's pixie sticks were packed with enough potassium cyanide to kill an adult, and the staples on the other 4 straws matched the stapler O'Brien had access to, the madman narrative crumbled. It was a forensic intersection of tool mark analysis, the stapler, alibi verification, the air traffic controller, and toxicology, the potassium cyanide salt. O'Brien had tried to use the invisible nature of cyanide to vanish into a crowd of victims, but he underestimated the lab's ability to trace the physical evidence back to his own hand. For the forensic community, the O'Brien case changed the way we look at tampering. It proved that a killer didn't need a lab or high-tech aerosol spray to be efficient. They just needed a basic understanding of a chemical reaction and a heart cold enough to watch their own children's premeditated death. It remains one of the most gruesome examples of how a dual citizen chemical like cyanide can be used to turn a holiday into a crime scene. And then, as we bring the science of murder into the present day, we encounter a killer who tried to hide in the sterile, high-tech halls of a university research lab. This is the case of Robert Ferrante, a world-class neurological researcher who used his professional access to bypass every red flag in the industrial supply chain. To truly understand this case, you have to look past the mass spectrometers and into the crumbling foundation of a power couple marriage. Dr. Autumn Klein wasn't just a victim. She was a brilliant neurologist in her own right, the chief of women's neurology at UPMC. She was a woman who dedicated her life to protecting the very brain functions her husband would eventually choose to terminate. The mask Ferrante wore wasn't just a lab coat. It was the persona of a doting, supporting husband. But behind the scenes, the relationship was strained by a toxic mix of professional jealousy and Ferrante's growing paranoia that Autumn was planning to leave him. He believed he wasn't just losing his wife, he was losing his appearance of status. On the night of April 17th, 2013, Autumn returned home after a long day at the hospital, exhausted. Ferrante, ever the caring partner, had prepared a specialized energy drink for her, a creatine supplement that he claimed would help with her fertility treatments as they tried for a second child. It was the ultimate betrayal of intimacy. He used her desire to create life as the vehicle to deliver her death. When she collapsed, the scene was chaotic. To the responding paramedics, it looked like a sudden tragic stroke, a clinical glitch in an otherwise healthy woman. However, Ferrante had his secret weapon, his education and professional credentials. He had used his university account to order potassium cyanide, ostensibly for his research into Lou Gehrig's disease. In the eyes of the suppliers, he wasn't a threat, he was a scientist. He was a man who belonged in the room with the very tools of molecular sabotage. Ferrante banked on the idea that his professional pedigree and his intimate knowledge of how to spark a metabolic collapse would grant him the perfect crime. He expected the doctors to see a natural death and simply sign the certificate. However, his behavior in the ER was the first red flag that didn't sit right with the attending physicians. Despite being a world-class researcher who understood the urgency of a medical crisis, he seemed strangely detached. He was performing grief rather than experiencing it. While he played the part of the grieving widower, investigators were digging into his digital life. They found that the man who claimed to be shocked by her stroke had been using his laboratory computer to research cyanide poisoning, how to remove data from a hard drive, and sudden cardiac arrest. He had ordered the potassium cyanide just 2 days before Adam collapsed, marking it for overnight delivery and hand signing for the package himself. A massive anomaly for a common lab reagent. The digital footprint of this order served as a direct chronological precursor to the metabolic shutdown he initiated in his own home. Franti forgot that while a doctor might see a stroke, the lab sees a quantitative reality. When the toxicology results came back from the lab, the GCMS didn't just find a trace of poison, it provided a quantifiable record of the lethal dose he administered. Franti didn't just tip the scale, he demolished it. At 2.2 milligrams per liter, Adam's blood was nearly five times past the point of no return. His professional credentials didn't matter. The data from the mass spectrometer was absolute. His cover of innocent researcher and dedicated husband was dismantled by the raw data of the blood toxicology. The most haunting part of the story is that Autumn, as a neurologist, would have recognized the symptoms of cellular hypoxia if she had seen them in a patient. But in the safety of her own kitchen, she never suspected that the energy drink handed to her by her partner was actually a molecular wrench designed to shut her down forever. The Ferrante case serves as a chilling reminder that the science of murder isn't always found in a dark alley. Sometimes it's found in the sterile white light of a prestigious lab or even a suburban home, wielded by someone who knows exactly which biological fuse to blow. From Scheele's 18th century workbench to the modern GCMS, cyanide remains the invisible killer that only science can see. It's a chemical paradox, an industrial staple that possesses the specific molecular geometry to dismantle human life in minutes. We've seen that while a social mask can be a powerful tool of deception, it can't fool science. It may have allowed a father to weaponize a holiday and a researcher to turn a fertility supplement into a lethal dose, but it ultimately failed them. These men didn't just try to hide behind their titles, they hid behind the perceived safety of their relationships. But in the laboratory, those social performances carry no weight. The analytical data is indifferent to the killer's persona. In the lab, we don't just process samples, we provide the keys to decode the final moments of a metabolic collapse. The science of murder proves that while a killer might understand the chemistry, they almost always underestimate the physics of the recovery. I'm Lissa, and while a killer might rely on the invisibility of a cellular shutdown, science operates on a different scale. The evidence is always there. You just have to know where to look and let it guide you to the answers. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on these cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Next week, we're stepping away from the toxicology bench for a special spotlight on Colleen Fitzpatrick, the DNA Doe pioneer who revolutionized how we used genetic genealogy to give names back to the nameless. Stay curious, stay scientific, and join us in our next episode.